Good afternoon, and welcome to Digging Deep on WDRT Community Radio, coming to you from the ground up here in the Driftless area of Wisconsin, specifically the town of Viroqua. And most of my shows are cooking shows, Who's in the Kitchen, but the last Saturday of the month at noon is Digging Deep, which is our farm show, and where we try to go a little deeper into the connection between food and farming and our health and the environment and the economy and food policy and whatever. And, you know, we have just a wonderful area in the Driftless area, full of small farms, a lot of organic farms. I think we're like third in the nation or something like that for organic farms. But anyway, you're listening to 91.9 FM, streaming live on the internet at WDRT.org, and then you can go to our archives, podcasts from previous shows. You either look up Digging Deep, which we've been doing for about 2 years, and Who's in the Kitchen. So my guest today is Rick Bieber from the fields of Sinsinoa, south of... what am I saying? Oh, Platteville. And I want to welcome Rick, and I'm so glad you're going to be on the show.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm kind of excited to have a conversation with you.
Right. I am, too. I'm totally excited, and I did go on your website, and I am just so impressed. So I'm hoping people will check that out, because a very beautiful website and a very complete... descriptions of activities and retreats and informal meetings and conferences and visits and field days and just so much going on. So I'm very happy to make this contact, Rick. I think it might be very helpful to us in the future with our show Digging Deep, because I'm trying to be in contact with farmers and farming movements, farming meetings going on, farming groups that are organized, soil conservation groups, water conservation groups, and relate this all to farming. And why should we care? Why should, you know, just regular old people who are, you know, listening to the radio, why do they care? And I'm hoping that that's the kind of show that it is. So I'm Philothea Beeson, and so we're just going to get started. And I first just really want Rick to describe who he is, because I thought it was just very interesting. He is a farmer going way back. So would you just start and introduce yourself, Rick?
I'm a farmer originally from South Dakota, born and raised on the family farm, which is in the middle of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation in north central South Dakota. And I retired in 2016 from the farm, and my son took over. He's the fifth generation there. So we went through many things and many transitions in the process of keeping a farm in the family for that many generations, including the financial stresses of the 80s. And they turned out to be a very rewarding time for us. We got our foreclosure notices and were able to live through that and work our way through that without any debt write-downs or bankruptcies or rich uncles dying.
Well, who gives you those notices? The bank?
The bank gave us the foreclosure notice.
Oh, dear.
We worked our way through that, and in the process of working our way through that, we discovered soil care. And so we looked at our soils with a different lens in our future. And we started just looking at what was best for the soils first, not what was best for us as man. We looked at what was best for the soils, and then the plants, and then the animals. And by doing that, it became quite profitable. So in the world of agriculture today, the people that are improving their land are called regenerative farmers, or they want to say they're improving their land. They're regenerative farmers. And So I guess you could say that's kind of when we started that journey then.
Did you even have that term at the time? Regenerative? No.
The term wasn't there. No-till farming. We were doing it before it was called no-till farming. Everybody pushed back against what we were doing because when I found something that was successful, I like to tell my neighbors and my friends about it or the people I go to church, whoever wants to talk farming with me. And word got out that we're doing this, and pretty soon there's a lot of pushback because what we were doing was quite simple, but it was quite contrary to what was being taught. And so in the process of doing this, whenever somebody would tell me that won't work, I would simply say it works on our farm and it pays my bills.
That's the best testimony, isn't it? It's working for me.
And if it's working continuously for a farmer, then it must be working. But there's so many times in agriculture today that we have so many outside influences into our financial statement that doesn't necessarily mean it's working. It means that you're able to survive financially.
Yeah, just surviving isn't exactly thriving.
Exactly.
And people have are invested in these lands, and sometimes over, like in your family, five generations. And you could say, well, your land was really cheap when you got it, but land is very valuable now. People are finding it's really hard to even buy farmland to farm.
That is true, and we do hear that, but it's relative.
Okay.
In the 80s, if there was zero money, it didn't matter if an acre cost $10 or $10,000, you could not get. There was no credit cards. There wasn't instant financing like we have today.
Right.
So all those things, are issues. It's relative term.
Mm-hmm.
So land is very expensive today, and a lot of times it's expensive like that because we've had those outside influences of subsidies and bridge payments or whatever you want to call the money that just gets handed because there's people that don't want to transform into a gentler soil care practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm talking with Rick Bieber, and I want you just to remind us what state and your farm is in and how many acres you have now.
I'm from South Dakota.
Okay.
And I retired in 2016. Mm-hmm. I didn't really want to retire. I was fairly young yet in the eyes of what farmers' ages are. But if I wanted my son to have his 40 chances of being a farmer, I had to get out of his way.
Okay.
So when I retired, he got everything. He got the land, the machinery. He got the cattle. He got the granaries full of grain. He got the debt associated with the land also.
Uh-huh.
He got everything, and he didn't have to operate under my shadow. I see so many father-son operations today that dad still makes most of the decisions, or he's there being the governor, casting a shadow on the son's decisions.
Mm-hmm.
So that brings me to where I'm at today, and I'm in Wisconsin, the very southwest corner at Sinsinawa, and the organization that is started is the Fields of Sinsinawa. It's a nonprofit. It's a farmer-led. We have a board of directors made up of all farmers and one Dominican sister, and we operate within the landscape or on the landscape of the Dominican sisters. And how this has started was Dave Brandt was known as the father of regenerative agriculture, and he was here doing a seminar many, many years ago, and some of the Dominican sisters listened to him, and they fell in love with the idea of regenerative agriculture.
Oh.
Dave Brandt was killed tragically in a car accident in 2023.
Oh.
So in the fall, a bunch of his friends got together and decided since and all to see if there's any kind of merit to what he talked about with being a learning center. And at that time, there was about 200 people got together and decided this does have a very, very significant, can play a significant role in changing agriculture because of the landscape, because of the sacredness of what it, where it's at. So the Dominican Sisters were quite thrilled that we wanted to form an organization. And the Dominican Sisters have been on the landscape here for about 170 plus years. And they've always been known as teachers. Their founding father was a teacher. So they've always been known as teachers, and they're aging because society is not entering into those type of professions anymore. So they're concerned about their legacy. So Field of Sense Now was put together as an educational organization, and it came onto their landscape as being a living classroom. So now their legacy remains teaching, but now the land is going to teach rather than the people in the classrooms. The teaching is going to be on the landscape, with the landscape.
Oh, that's just so wonderful. So describe this landscape. What's the size and what does it look like? Where is it located?
The first time I came was in 2023, September of 2023, and I instantly fell in love with it because of the topography of the landscape. It's called the Mound. It's one of the driftless areas, very southern part of Wisconsin in the driftless area. The driftless area have several mounds, but the Dominican Sisters have one that they own, and there's not quite 500 acres of landscape here. And what thrilled me about it is how it lays. When you look at it, you instantly can see that when God gives you a raindrop on top of that mound, that big karst pile of rocks that is there, that has tree is tree covered, when God gives us that raindrop, and if it comes in massive quantities, it tends to want to run somewhere. And in this particular case, the top of the mound is 300 feet higher than the lowest landscape we have. That's a significant drop for those acres. And we can monitor that water. And we have, most research farms and demonstrations farms have to deal with somebody else's water. If there's too much, it'll run from somebody else's property or flow from somebody else's property onto theirs. In this particular landscape here, we own three of our own watersheds. It falls on top of the mound when God gives it to us, and we can monitor it as it leaves our landscape also. And we have monitoring stations set up to do this, and we have one on all native pasture land. We have one set up on 100% tilled land. Our whole landscape is organically farmed, so there's tillage here yet. We have one set up on all tilled area, and then we have one set up on the forest area, and we have one set up on a perennial stream where the neighbors give us some water. And our cleanest water so far is coming off our tilled land.
Wow.
And it's also the least amount of water coming off is on our tilled land.
No kidding.
And we're measuring it for flow, the volume. We're measuring it for particulate matter, and we're measuring it for the particulate matter shows how much erosion comes off our land. And we're also measuring it for nutrient load that comes with the water.
Is this water all open streams, or you have springs, or both?
They're both. And what is kind of neat about what we're doing, we have a program that we started here called carbon benchmarking, where we're actually sending the soils in to find out what the total nutrient digestion of the soils are, the total carbon, not organic and not and not all the little factions that everybody wants to talk about. We want to know what the total amount is.
The total amount of what?
Carbon.
Okay.
because carbon is our best filter so far, we know that if we change the carbon concentration in the soil, we can change the water quality of the soil also.
Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Many times we get water, rainwater will come, and we will have nothing flowing out of our through our water monitoring stations during the rain event. And even after the rain event, for hours, it won't flow. And a day or two later, they'll start flowing. And that means that the water is infiltrating into the soil.
Yeah.
Until the soil is at capacity, and then it gently leaks out wherever it needs to leak out.
Mm-hmm.
But as it leaks out, it's pure water. It's not, doesn't have any nitrate with it, no phosphorus with it, none of the, the stuff that's contaminating our rivers and lakes.
Well,
so we
get
to monitor all that.
Oh, that's wonderful. You know, I think it's just so miraculous that the soil cleans the water. I mean,
absolutely.
Isn't that a miracle? You know, talk to little kids about it. You know, where does our water come from? It comes from under the ground, and yet it's not filled with dirt. How does that happen? It's just.
We offer, one of our mottos is, we didn't know this at the time, but it's the exact same motto as the founding father, Mazda Kali, who started the Dominican Sisters. His motto was, all are welcome. And that's the sign that we put on our sign also. It says, all are welcome. So we give tours whenever people want to have tours. And we get quite a few people that want to stop for a tour individually, and or we can handle up to 60 at a time.
So do some people just live there now? How many people live there on that place?
I don't know the exact count. There's a set of apartments here.
Okay.
They turned the old college into apartments.
Uh-huh.
And then the old convent itself is administration office type buildings. And then there's also another building there. It's I forget what they call it right now. That building there still is going to be preserved, but at the moment they're deconstructing the convent portion that was built in 1964.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a massive project, but because they don't have the numbers of people to continue to occupy that and the expense of occupying it, they searched very hard to find people to occupy it. The Dominican Sisters did. And mm-hmm. they're in the process of deconstructing that portion of the complex here. So,
well, what a wonderful infrastructure that you were able to get. I mean, buildings and dorms and office space and, you know.
Well, I want to make it clear, we don't have any of that. Fields of Cincinnati is an educational organization, and we operate within the landscape.
I see.
We don't have, the Dominican Sisters still manage all the buildings. They still own all the buildings and are going to.
Okay.
That we deal with soils, we deal with functionality of soils, mm-hmm. water, things like that. Is what we are, and we're an educational organization only. We're not a management organization.
Oh, okay. But, I mean, if I came down there, just drove down there, who would be there? Are there people on, you know, there daily on the land?
There's offices. Mm-hmm. And you'd walk in, and they would direct you to the appropriate place. Julia Gerlach is the project manager, the head person for Fields of Cincinnati. She mm-hmm. keeps that website current for us.
Mm-hmm.
Her office is up in that particular part or that complex on site.
Mm-hmm.
And then I've got a building down below here that the Dominican Sisters have leased to us.
I see.
And
okay.
We're in the process of trying to figure out how to incorporate that into being our home site. But right now, it's just an old farm building. It's a maintenance shed is where I'm calling and talking to you from right now.
Okay. So I want to let people know, because this has just been very informative. I'm talking to Rick Bieber. And what is your role? What is your title? Do you have a title?
Well, for my lifetime, people have been trying to pin me with a title. I've been dodging all of them. But my business card says Rick Bieber, Soil Caretaker.
Okay. Soil Caretaker at Fields of Sinsinawa.
Yes.
Is that right? And what is the nearest town?
We're 7 miles east of Dubuque, Iowa.
Okay.
We're about 15 miles northwest of Galena, Illinois.
Okay.
And about 20 miles south of Platteville, Wisconsin.
Okay, so, yeah, Iowa, Illinois, and Wisconsin.
Yes, we're right.
Yes,
if we
right
get
there.
On a high, if we get on our higher ground and we look to the south, we can see Illinois. If we look to the west, we can see Iowa. But we are in Wisconsin.
Can you see the Mississippi River Valley from there?
Yes.
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 Okay, I'm sure people want to know, where does the word Sinsinawa come from? It just sounds to me like it's Native American.
I believe it is, uh-huh. And some of that history, I guess my pay grade is not high enough to know it all. If anybody's interested, there's huge, huge amounts of archive stuff here, and they do have people on site that can give you a tour through the Dominican Sisters' history of being here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as far as the religious side of it goes, they do have, and that's an 8 to 4 time frame that you show up and they'll give you the tour there.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I don't know for sure. I would uh-huh. be misspeaking if I tried to explain that.
Right. And so then I was actually talking with Julia. I met Julia at a party, which is where I really meet most of my guests, is in socializing and finding interesting people. So Julia was the one who put me in touch with you. And there's a connection between that and the organic movement and the first organic conference that was formed called Moses. Right? Or Mosa? Moses. Moses. Do you know anything of that history?
I'm going to back you up just a wee bit.
Okay.
The person that put you in touch with me was Sister Julie. She's a Dominican sister.
Okay. This is a different... And you were talking about Julia.
Yes, Julia. Okay. Very confusing to me because I almost on a daily basis, I deal with both of them, and one is Julie and one's Julia.
Okay.
As far as the Moses conference went, the Dominican sisters were part of that very early on. I did not start it, but they were very, very instrumental very early on. And the conference was held here on site for many years until it outgrew the facility here.
I see.
And then it moved.
And it moved to La Crosse.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. And I don't know if you've been there long enough, but I've been in the Driftless area for over 50 years, and I've really seen a lot of this stuff come about. Just so fascinating. And so the organic conference has grown every year, and now it's not called Moses. It has another name, but it's still in La Crosse every year, I think in February. And, you know, the whole organic movement, I mean, you were part of it without even, I don't know, really naming it when you started working on your own farm and really investigating soil care. So
we were
yeah.
in the process of trying to make a living farming. We had no money, so we had to figure it out without money. And after we started making some money, I was young. I'm in my late 20s thinking I should do this because I'm very, I will march to my own drum to a certain point, but I also need to pay attention to what's going on in the world. And at that time, the promotion is still for yield. And so you know, to get the maximum yield, we need to apply synthetic inputs. So we went down that path for many, many years, and our farm did quite well and was a picture perfect farm. We did tours literally from around the world to our farm.
And what was your crops?
We grew wheat and corn, when back in the 70s and 80s, mm-hmm. because the government paid us well to grow wheat, but it didn't pay us well enough to survive. But and then after we got our foreclosure notices, we started growing wheat and corn and alfalfa and peas and chickpeas and flax and sunflowers and a multitude of everything else, radishes, you name it, we seemed like we tried it. And certain things worked very well. Certain things worked okay. Certain things didn't work. But as we started learning the soils and asking the questions, we started learning what was happening to our soils by getting these maximum yields. And it's good to know those things. But I'm starting to question our food, and I'm starting to question the process of making our food, because farmers are supposed to be food producers, not necessarily commodity producers. Today, so many of them are commodity producers.
Oh, could you describe the difference?
A commodity is where you just don't have a name to it. You just have a bulk thing that you go sell because if you have X amount of pounds, and it might be X amount of bushels, and you just go to somebody and they just say, okay, I'll take it here. I'll pay you this.
By weight or whatever.
By weight, yeah. Yes.
And then it's not necessarily actually food, or who is it for? It's not something you find in a grocery store.
Well,
the commodities are more like feed or raw material.
Not necessarily. It can be, but if it's a commodity, you really don't know what's going to happen to it.
Oh, I see. Okay.
You give it to somebody else and they determine what's going to happen to it.
Like corn might turn into alcohol or might turn into corn syrup or who knows.
Yes. Or it might get fed, or it might be tacos or something like taco chips or something like that.
Okay.
For when you start growing food, now you start going, okay, I'm growing nutrients, and I'm providing nutrients to my fellow humans, or I'm providing nutrients to animals so the animals can provide the nutrients for my fellow humans. That's how I differentiate the two. Is one, you tend to want to know where it goes. And the other one, you just kind of go, here, get rid of it, give me some money.
Right. Well, I want to back up a little bit. You said that you were a successful farm in growing wheat until you went bankrupt. So I'm thinking, what happened? Was there just a drop in the demand for wheat, or what? Why wasn't it successful then? What was?
Well, you have to understand the economics of the 1980s. Our farm was paid for that I grew up on, mm-hmm. and some neighboring land come up for sale. And everybody's saying, get big, get big, get more.
Okay.
So my father went and borrowed some money to buy some more land. And about that same time, the interest rates skyrocketed 20-some percent. The government stepped in and devalued the land. So now all of a sudden you thought you probably had 40% equity in your land or whatever you had. And the next year you have zero equity in your land because of the devaluation that happened. And when that happens, you instantly, the bank just goes, I'm going to foreclose on these loans.
Okay, now does inflation and devaluation, they kind of go hand in hand? It's like the money is worth less and less, right?
Well, it is. That's inflation type of thing. But devaluation is when somebody makes a judgment call and will say, this whatever you have is worth X number of dollars today, but tomorrow it's worth half that amount because somebody's judgment. It wasn't because of the marketplace. It was purely a judgment call.
And that comes from the government?
That come from through the FHA type of thing because of the borrowings situation back. And it was a strange time that that can happen again. I don't believe it will, because there's been a tremendous amount of regulatory things went into place during the 80s that are going to stop some of this. But one of the things were that they can no longer foreclose. If you got a farm, they can no longer foreclose and kick you out of your house. You know, back then they could foreclose and you had to leave your home even, you know. So those type of regulations have been put in place. I don't know if they still are, but they were from about 20 years, or in my early years they were. But getting back to Fields of Sensenawa, we have many projects going on here. We have two different cattle herds here. We have a herd of bred dairy heifers, and we use adaptive grazing management with those animals to get them to eat all of our undesirable plants. And they're doing very well with that. They are on virtual collars. So we tell them where to go with our telephone or with our computers. So they wear a necklace, and if they get it to an area that they're not supposed to be, an audible sound comes on, and if they take another step forward, then they get a light shock. If they take another step forward, they get a more intense shock. So they very quickly learn when the sound goes off, they just turn around and go the other direction.
So they'll actually eat thistles and burdock and things like that, or what?
Absolutely. We got more videos of them eating all this dock and the thistles and the burdock and gooseberry bushes and multiflora
roses. Yeah, the roses.
So we've got our thistle population just about taken care of with our animal grazing.
That's
been the easy one to do. The multiflora rose, we've got them to cut back or eat back on that also. And how we've done this, we have a vet that looks in on us quite frequently to make sure our animal care is proper. The animals we have, we don't own. We have tenant farmers, and they will come up here and look at their animals to make sure they're okay. And the option to them is we can do fecal samples on them or blood samples on them or whatever they want, just to make sure we're not being cruel to them. But we ask our animals to eat a lot of things that most people don't think animals will eat.
Yeah.
And how we do that is we take all the mineral away from the animals except salt. And then we make the animals go to the soils or to the plants to get their minerals they need.
And they'll do that.
So if they need a copper molecule, they'll go to this plant to get it. If they need a zinc molecule, they'll go to that plant to get it. And we've been at this for a number of years. We've done this in South Dakota for decades already. And it works very, very nicely to get them to eat some of these undesirables. Another thing we do is we measure the sugar content of different plants. And if we want to, how we started them to get to eat the Canadian thistles is we measure the sugar content of the Canadian thistles. And when it's the highest sugar content of that plant and much higher than the other plants that are surrounding it, we expose our cows to those thistles at that time. They go up there and smell, and they like the smell of that Canadian thistle because it's high sugar, so they eat it first.
Oh, that's just really fascinating, and it makes you really want to come down and visit and go to one of these field days or conferences or something.
But as we do all these things, we want science to actually verify what we're doing, because if you come visit us and you have an interest in this and it looks good to you, we don't want you to go back home and try it and in 3 or 5 years go, oh, I should have never done what they recommended because I have a bigger mess or I have this issue now. And maybe the bigger mess is the water quality went the wrong direction. or maybe the erosion factor got higher.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe you got undesirable plants, or maybe your bird population went down. So we don't want any of that to happen. So we have the science coming in and doing some of this testing to show, according to the science, this is the right direction that Fields of Sinstow is heading with these soils.
Wow. There's so many things to consider. Oh, my gosh. I'm kind of overwhelmed.
Well, there is. But the thing is, if we look at things more of a individual things in a complex system, and in today's science, we have, and I just told you, we want to have science defend what we're doing, and it does. But we also have a lot of the science out there that has gotten so reductionistic in their view of how they do things, mm-hmm. that they want to measure one matrix. And the matrix that's going towards agriculture, well, there's actually two matrices, and one is efficiency and the other is yield.
Yeah.
And the two don't always go hand in hand, but a lot of times they will. But as we look at the most efficient and also the highest yield, if we look at the soils aspect of it, if we look at the ecosystem below the soil surface, that's so out of balance, because what's happened with trying to become efficient and push yields. If we step back and look at a system that we start looking at and understanding the livestock aspect of it, and then we start understanding the soil armor aspect of it, or the diversity aspect of it, or the living root aspect of it, or the disturbance aspect of it, and we look at those, and we recognize that the other four of those five soil care principles are equally as important as each and every one of them, it's no longer so complicated.
Well, it's very holistic, isn't it? As opposed to reductionist, as you were saying.
Yeah.
And the thing is, the problem with that model of just efficiency and yield is that eventually the soil is getting, what are you seeing? It's degrading the soil. And what will you see? Well, it's degrading not only the soil, but other things.
It's degrading the life in the soil.
The life,
it's causing a lot of it to go dormant, and some of it dies, but most of it goes dormant because it's not feeding the life below the soil surface. Its primary nutrient that it lives on is carbon, photosequestered carbon. And if we don't provide that carbon to our soils, now it has to get that from somewhere else. And we had soils that were very, very rich before our band started manipulating them so drastically. And there's a pool of carbon that's in there. It's called the legacy pool. And that's the stuff that's, if we're looking at food, which carbon is food, if we're looking at that, let's compare it to human food. So you have food that you grow in your garden, you have food that's in your refrigerator, you have food that's in your pantry, and you have food that's in your freezer. And the stuff that's in your freezer, vacuum packed in your freezer, is probably got as long as shelf life. So that'd be your legacy carbon in comparison. The photosequestered carbon, that's the stuff that you grow out of your garden. That's that. And that's the stuff we would prefer to eat, is the fresh stuff, the never frozen stuff, mm-hmm. the never processed stuff. Mm-hmm. And this, all life is that way. I mean, our animals are that way. You know, the life below the soil is that way also. So it wants to have a photosequestered carbon molecule. And we can monitor those carbon molecules, and we can actually find out what plants that carbon molecule came from.
Oh, really?
And yes, through some of the tests that today's modern science has, we can measure that carbon molecule, what plant it came from. Did it come from a corn plant, or did it come from a ragweed, or did it come from an oak tree, or did it come from a wheat plant, or of the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of plants out there, thousands of plants out there, each one has a service to the soil's ecosystem. And what we did when we, as man, no matter where you're at, whether you live 2,000 years ago or today, we've disrupted that by saying, I want to have carrots growing right here, and I don't want to have another plant growing with that carrot.
Uh-huh.
And now all of a sudden, the biology that lives off the carbon molecule from the carrot kind of gets fat because he's the king, the carrot's the king. But every other biological thing within that realm of that carrot root is going, where's my carbon molecule? And everybody goes, everybody below the ground goes, you don't get one because that plant's not there.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about grazing, the eating, the processing of the food, and preserving, making manure. How do the grazing animals fit in and actually improve the soil?
Well, the animals eat whatever animals eat, and we can all say animals will eat grass, but they eat many, many things.
Mm-hmm.
And this is some science also that has been well researched that shows that animals generally eat plants according to sugar contents. And with cows or ruminating animals, they get up before daylight and they very ferociously eat if you're not subsidizing their food with something else. But they get up before daylight and they very ferociously eat. Once their carbohydrate needs are met, mainly through the grasses, they'll lay down and rest. And that's usually about 10 o'clock in the morning. And this is whether you're in South Africa or Australia or in Finland or you're here in North America, because it's a certain length from daylight to resting time. After they're done resting, because they've got the proper amount of carbohydrates within their body, now they get up and they start looking for tannins and alkaloids that will slow their gut biology down. They're looking for things that are actually have a little bit of a poisonous factor to them, because the biology is reproducing in their gut so prolifically that, and the biology gives off gas that if they don't slow it down when they go to rest at night, they're going to bloat because they can't pass gas out the front or out the back.
Mm-hmm.
Because their middle gut has it trapped. So this is the natural process that happens when we confine our animals, or we just throw them out in a pasture and just let them roam at will. They're going to eat the most highest sugar content stuff all the time. And the lower sugar content stuff, they're never going to touch. And pretty soon your pastures become overgrazed, even though they might be 3 feet high. And I see that all the time here in Wisconsin. The pastures are so significantly overgrazed, yet there's plants out there that are 3 feet high. And the plants that are out there that are 3 feet higher, the dock and the thistles.
Yes.
And things like that.
Well, so this is where rotational grazing comes in?
Well, rotational grazing is putting animals out there for a specific amount of time. Say you got six pastures and you're going to equally graze them. So you divide it out, you're going to rotate them through there twice. So that's 12 moves throughout the year. You just go up to the calendar and go, okay, I got every 2 weeks I need to move my animals.
Mm-hmm.
Which is pretty good, but that still will cause your pasture to be overgrazed and undergrazed, because it's kind of like offering your kids something to eat, and they know they're going to have something else to eat in a few hours. They're not going to clean up their vegetables like you want them to clean up their vegetables, because they know they're going to get something else a little bit later.
Uh-huh.
So the cows will do the same thing. They'll walk around these plants and not eat on them.
Uh-huh.
And all that we're doing is with adaptive grazing management, if our cows are up and eating between 10 o'clock and 2 o'clock in the afternoon, that means they didn't get their carbohydrates for the day out of the grasses, which means the soils were not balanced to feed the plants like they needed to be fed. And the animals will actually tell us, because they're grazing, that soil's being injured. Get them moved.
Oh, my goodness. I'm just going to quick take a little break. You're listening to WDRT 91.9 FM, coming from Viroqua, Wisconsin. This show is Digging Deep, and we're digging deep today with with Rick Biebers from Fields of Sinsinawa, which is an area that's devoted to regenerative farming. And you can find this show. I'm just taking mad notes, and I'm going to go back. You can find this show by going to our archives at Digging Deep at WDRT 91.9 FM, WDRT.org. And you can listen to Digging Deep the last Saturday of every month at noon. We just cover a wide variety of topics, but I'm finding this very interesting, and I'm hoping that people who are interested in a farming show are getting something out of this. And also, just to understand food and its relationship to, you know, our lives and to the earth and to water and to the animals and to the whole ecosystem. It's just really fascinating. Thank you so much, Rick. We'll just go on, but I wanted to take a little break and let people know what they were listening to.
So I'm a lifetime farmer, and many of these practices I talk about, we've always had livestock on our farm. I grew up with Dad and Mom milking cows, and they left the farm when I was in high school, and we had pigs and sheep and chickens and everything a farm has. And we still today, my son has taken over the farm about 10 years ago, and we still today have a large beef herd out there, mama cows with calves that we sell as feeder calves in the fall, or he sells, I should say. I include it as we, but it's his farm. So a lot of these things that I talk about here at Fields of Sinsinawa, I've lived.
Yes, and what is the reason, what is the wisdom behind a variety of animals on the farm? I mean, people did it, and they seem to be successful, and we've moved kind of away from that, haven't we? The new model is all one crop and all one kind of beast, and, you know, what is the benefit of having all the different animals?
I think the reason why they had them in the first place is because you get tired of eating just chicken all day long.
Okay.
You know, it'd be nice to have some pork and some beef and some chicken and all this stuff.
Nothing
and
more then, esoteric than that.
Yeah, and we have to have some eggs, you know, for breakfast and things like that. So, and also once we started getting into maybe selling some stuff, I don't know, might have been 100 or 200 years ago or something like that, where we started selling. When people started living in towns and they needed food, people on farms started taking their products to these towns and things like that. So now all of a sudden, okay, I'm going to be raise a lot of extra beef so I can take it in and the meat market can get it and the people in town can eat on it.
Yeah.
And then we started looking at efficiencies and things like that, and we recognized that those few pigs that I have out back, I can buy from my neighbor that has a lot of pigs. I can buy them cheaper than I can raise them myself.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And the chicken guy, he wants to raise chickens, and the neighbor goes, I can buy the eggs in town cheaper than I can grow them myself, because my time and money can be spent being more efficient doing something else.
Mm-hmm.
And in today, most farmers don't actually even eat any of their own produce. Most farmers don't have a chicken anymore, so they have to buy all their eggs. There's a tremendous amount of farmers that have a garden because they like to have a fresh tomato, but they don't even grow any cucumbers or carrots or beets or potatoes anymore. Mm-hmm. They buy them. So that's part of the reason why we've consolidated everything into, I'm going to be a beet grower, or I'm going to be a cucumber grower, you know, versus, or I'm going to be a potato grower or a cotton grower or whatever. I think it's the efficiency of how we look at what our time is worth.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that would be part of my unscientific reason for why that happens or happened.
Mm-hmm. But there was a kind of wisdom, I think, among farmers, and it's not like it was necessarily scientific, but just the idea of, say, rotating crops and not growing the same crop on the same land every year, and putting manure on land. Well, you had to get rid of the manure, but I mean, I think you found that the soil was better for having used the manure that way. And you have too much manure now, and now it's a problem for some farms, and they have to get rid of it somewhere and spray it on other people's land. And
before mechanization took over, whatever you put in a barn, you had to carry feed to the barn, and then you had to carry manure away from the barn.
Right.
And before mechanization took over, the farmers were pretty intelligent, going, I'll just let that cow walk over there to the corner of the pasture to poop rather than have to do it in the barn and then haul it out. So I think that's part of it, is mechanization has caused a lot of that right there, especially in the animal side of things.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't want to let our animals be animals anymore. They're the same thing. They're a commodity.
Mm-hmm.
I've got 20,000 hogs I'm raising for some company that owns the hogs, and you're basically doing the labor for them, or chickens, or whatever. Maybe it's 10,000 beef cows or something like that. Or 10,000 milk cows or something like that. So I don't know if it's ever going to get back to the very, very small commodity farm food grower that went to his backyard and didn't hardly have to buy anything except maybe coffee like they did in the 1800s. And I really don't want to go back to having getting clinkers out of the coal furnace like I did when I was a kid growing up.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So these modern conveniences that we have are nice, and I don't really want to give those things up, but I think we need to look at our soils differently, and we can do that with today's technology. And I think we're in a transitional period right now for the commodity type farmers, and in South Dakota my son is still very much a commodity type farmer. Those type farmers are seeing more and more stress on the marketplace because our population is somewhat stabilized, but our production has continued to skyrocket up, and there's just not enough places for our commodities to go anymore. The people around the world that were known to be starving to death, that percent has continued to go down and down and down to where they're being more self-sufficient and things like that. So our production has went up drastically, and our usage has went down, which means our price is going to go down also, because there's a glut of the products out there.
Mm-hmm. You know, we had the Dust Bowl in the 30s because of just really growing the same crop over and over again and tilling and so forth, and not replenishing the soil? What did cause the Dust Bowl?
Well, you're right in your description, and there's many, many causes to it, but the biggest cause was not understanding soil function.
Mm-hmm.
And the tillage is one of the disturbances out there, and that was the only disturbance back in those days. Now we have two other disturbances to our soils. But the soil particles in themselves, whether it's clay, sand, or silt, whatever, those are your soil particles, they in themselves are just a minute stone that you can't even see, like a clay particle you can't see with your eye hardly at all. But that particular piece of geology, it is held together by glues in the soil. And those glues, as they start building and get put together, the biology puts these glues in there. And it builds a home for itself, and that home is called an aggregate, a soil aggregate. And that's the home for the biology. And this particular family of biology is responsible for putting this particular type of glue in that. So one revert, using the analogy of home building, one particular family of biology perhaps uses nails. Another one uses mortar. Another one uses glue. Another one uses tape. Another one uses screws. Another one uses rebar. And you got all these little biological builders in the soil putting all these soil particles together, mm-hmm. and defend them. If they're alive and thriving, they defend them just like you defend your home at home. When the wind comes up and tears something off your house, you put it back on. You defend your house.
Mm-hmm.
The biology does this also because that aggregate is its home, and it's saying to the world that you cannot have that little clay particle or that little sand particle because that's part of my home. That's a brick in my house.
Mm-hmm.
And these soil biology live on carbon. And they live on all these different carbon molecules from all these different plants, the diversity of plants.
Mm-hmm.
And if we've taken all the diversity away, now we don't have diverse food. And now we don't have the guys out there making all these diverse type of glues that hold our soils together. And that glue, incidentally, is called glomalin.
Oh, I've never heard that term before.
It's the glue that holds soils together.
Mm-hmm.
And glomalin by itself only lasts a short period of time unless it's continually replaced. And if we allow our soil temperatures to get high enough, like up to 102 degrees, is when glomalin starts just melting like chocolate.
Mm.
And now all of a sudden your soil particles will fall apart. And now when you get a raindrop, the energy of the raindrop in itself becomes the bomb on bare soil that destroys the soil particles.
I see.
But if you have living plants providing living carbon, feeding the living biology has a constant maintenance program for the soil aggregate.
Mm-hmm.
And all the rain in the world will not wash soil away.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have to say that our hour is up, and I have so much enjoyed talking with you, Rick. And you do explain things that I think us people with maybe a fifth grade understanding of stuff could really follow, and I just appreciate so much that you have been on our show today, Digging Deep. And Rick Bieber is from the fields of Sinsinawa, which is between Dubuque and Platteville and Galena, in that very southwestern corner of the Driftless area. And Fields of Sinsinawa is a wonderful website and Facebook presence, and if you've been interested in this show, you can check that out. Thank you so much, Rick, for being on Digging Deep today.
Well, thank you for having me. And if nothing else, I hope I caused some of your listeners to think differently.
Well, I'm sure you did. So thank you to my listeners for tuning in to Digging Deep on WDRT Community Radio from the ground up.